So I got this job this morning because Wayne and I actually landed up working on the same mountain. So we've been busy hooking our sermons onto a mountain theme, and Wayne had booked me for the 7th of September, and I started working on something and got all very excited until I opened up the Hillside newsletter to find that Wayne had stolen my sermon. So I asked God, why on earth would I be preparing a sermon that I don't need to preach? And was wondering, I even said to Dylan last Friday night, well, if Wayne suddenly says he's sick, then I'll just say, all right, no, I've got this covered, I'll go for it. And then that's not what happened last week, although he was starting to feel sick. He just didn't ask for prayer at the time, so he didn't know he had an out. And so I'm doing part two of what we started last week, and we trust that God is going to bring something fresh and new, even though we are dwelling on the same mountain, unbeknownst to a lot of you. So our story starts with David, and David was a man who had a dream. He could say, I have a dream. And it wasn't a wishy-washy, vague dream at all. He had the exact plan for it. He had the materials planned out. He had the measurements. He had the people. He had the resources. He had organized everything to execute his dream. It was bothering him that he had a beautiful palace as the king, and the Ark of the Covenant was sitting in a tent, in a makeshift tent. So he wanted to find a place for the Ark of the Covenant to rest and find permanence and have a more magnificent home. But as he dialogued with God, it was obvious that God did not envisage him building a temple, and that it was going to be his son Solomon who was going to build the temple. But he still went about making preparations. He figured out who would be the stone cutters, who was going to be the priestly people in the temple, who was going to be the gatekeepers, the singers, the treasurers, the army commanders, the officers of the tribes, the king's overseers. They all mentioned there in 1 Chronicles, chapters 22 to 28, and a lot of them are mentioned by name. Who's going to do all this work? You can see that he also started praying a lot for Solomon's holiness, because he realized that if Solomon wasn't right with God, Solomon wasn't going to build the temple either. So David finally handed over the plans to Solomon with all his which inner rooms, outer rooms, storerooms, places for atonement, everything that the Spirit of God had put in David's mind. And he had collected incredible resources. He seemed very wealthy himself. He had gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, onyx, all involved in this temple. And he donated a lot of his personal wealth. And then he did what we would call crowdfunding, where other people around him also donated their wealth. So the resources were ready. And soon after that, David did pass away. And we read about Solomon interacting with God, where he was granted wisdom, and very soon after that, Solomon does put his attention on building this temple that his father had envisaged. And so he asks a king, who's not even a Jewish king, a Phoenician king, for wood and some skilled men. It seemed that when David built his own palace, he had relied on the same Phoenician king to provide wood and resources. And Solomon organized some carriers and stone cutters and a few foremen, and it was ready for them to start building. Now, they needed to select a place to build this temple. And while it doesn't say in amongst all these resources and people and all the details that David had in his head, I really do believe that David knew where this temple was built, because he did seem to have everything else very mapped out. And we read in 2 Chronicles that the very place where they selected to build the temple was actually on the same mountain that we were dwelling on last week, where the mountain called Mount Moriah, where Abraham was asked to sacrifice his very own son. And it's interesting that this place where David and Solomon were building a temple, a place for people to come to be atoned for their sins, to worship God, was already a place of sacrifice. In fact, Wayne entitled his sermon last week, Mount Moriah, a place of sacrifice. And that is the very spot. And when we look back at last week's story, we see how Abraham called this place, the Lord will provide. And wow, it's clear that not only did God provide a ram for Abraham to actually sacrifice, but that God had now provided all these resources and these skills and these plans to build a magnificent temple. And it says there back in Genesis, so Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. David too had a history with this spot. And it's a bit of an odd story in that David angers God by taking a census of the fighting men that he had available. And he was actually warned against this by a man named Joab, who encouraged David to trust God about the numbers. We have music. Who's playing music? Is Alex playing music that's connecting to our speakers? Well, that's always interesting. I have the same situation at school. A lot of our computers are connected to these smart boards, and they all have the same code. So if you've been in another teacher's classroom connecting, or she's been in your classroom connecting, it means that when her computer connects to your board, suddenly voices and all sorts of things happen outside. So, okay. So David had counted the fighting men, and that had been taken as a sign of not trusting that God was actually, that God had the numbers sorted. And he was warned not to count, but that Joab said to him, may the Lord multiply his troops 100 times over. And so as a result, God sent a plague and sent an angel to destroy Jerusalem because David had not trusted that God would sort out the number of fighting men that he needed. And just as the angel was about to destroy Jerusalem, God stopped the angel and instructed David to rather build an altar. And this sounds very similar to the story of Abraham and his sacrifice, where he's about to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. And God says, no, stop. Here is a sacrificial thing instead to take place. So here, Jerusalem is meant to be destroyed because of David's lack of faith, and then God instructs him to build an altar. But He instructs him to build an altar on another man's threshing floor, a man who's a Canaanite. He's not even a Jew. So David goes to him and says, please, can I buy this space for my altar? And this guy says, I think he's terrified of David. He basically says, sure, you can have it for free. I'll provide the oxen. You can have it. But David says, no, he needs to pay for this. He can't use this other man's resources. And so David builds this altar for the sacrifice and offers a burnt offering for Israel and his own sins. And it's that spot that Solomon chooses to build his magnificent temple, that mountain, that place. And so Solomon does a great job of following through and making sure that the temple is built, and it becomes a place for people to go and meet with God, a place to go and offer sacrifices, a place to go and worship. And as Wayne mentioned last week, the space where that happened is very close to the space where Jesus offered himself as a sacrifice, as a substitute. And we again find a sacrificial spot with a substitute, where Jesus becomes the lamb that is offered up instead of us, people. And we have a mirroring of sacrifice again, with the Lord providing a sacrifice for sin. So the temple doesn't stand in that spot anymore. But Jesus had paid the ransom for us, so we don't need to go to a particular place. And Jesus had already kind of alluded to the fact that he was going to be the new temple. He had told the disciples in John, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And the Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his own body. And the New Testament talks about us bringing sacrifices to God, even though we are not bound by having to offer sacrificial animals to God. In Romans, it says, therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. And then in Hebrews, through Jesus, therefore, let us continually offer to God a sacrifice of praise, the fruit of lips that openly profess his name, and do not forget to do good and to share with others, for with such sacrifices God is pleased. So God is bringing in an element of sacrifice for us as well. And what does this mean? Do we need to sacrifice absolutely everything we love so that we are walking around very somber? Maybe we should be dressed completely in black and not show much of a passion or a delight for anything. And I really don't think that that's God's picture. We are his living beings who are meant to be sprouting and growing, and I don't think us walking around somber and looking very pious expresses life and joy that we hear about in the Bible. I'm reading about a book about a lady who marries into a very Orthodox Jewish community. And so far, she gets into trouble with this community a lot. She decides to she marries and she has some stepchildren who are struggling with the fact that their own mom died. And so she kind of introduces a dancing time after bathing to cheer them up. And the neighbors are outraged. The community spends their time gossiping about her until finally the mother-in-law of the person who dies comes to have a word with her that she really is causing trouble by playing this unpious music with these children. And it's frowned upon to wear red, and she has to put a lot of rules on herself to fit into this community. And we can think of lots of communities, not only Orthodox Jews. We can think of many, many communities who have gone the route of looking very serious, dressing very seriously, not really showing a lot of delight and joy. And yet we read about a God who delights in beauty and who has created incredible beauty. And I am convinced that if he was here walking with us, we could delight together in the beauty of flowers and the incredible colors of peacocks and sunsets. And I also think God delights in the various personalities that he's created. Where sometimes we don't see the beauty of the complexity of the people that we're dealing with. I just know from having class after class after class, I've now been teaching for 20-something years, not quite sure, I've lost count. So every year I get a new class of children for 3 weeks, so I'm not really sure about them. They don't seem like my old class, they seem very babyish. And little by little, I find that they start to creep into my heart. But they always have a completely different flavor from another class that I've taught, because the individual personalities just bring something so new and so fresh. And I've learned over the years, you know, the children who are happy to tackle the rain spider that comes into the classroom, and the children who arrive at my desk and really need a special hug because they're just feeling out of sorts. And which children are going to say something very bizarre about? I start to learn the different personalities and be able to predict what these children are going to do. This year I have a child who likes to bring a small leopard to school, a toy leopard. And she's very creative, so she, at one stage, this leopard, whose name is Spot, broke his leg. So she had a whole paper cast contraption thing that she had made for him, and I was getting daily reports on how his recovery was coming along. And these are all the sort of delightful things that I think God looks over his people, and he knows which of us love cats and which ones love dogs and which ones love sunsets and which ones are going to really be blessed by seeing a certain bird come into our garden. And he knows all our idiosyncrasies, and I think that he takes delight over us and our idiosyncrasies. And C.S. Lewis said in The Weight of Glory, "It would seem that our Lord finds that our desires are not too strong, but they're too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about when infinite joy is offered us." And he compares us to children making mud pies in a slum because we cannot imagine going to the beach and having a holiday at the beach to build in the sand and having sand castles. So I don't think that the things that we delight in are a problem, unless they are we're delighting in them more than God. But I think that if we are delighting in God and we are bringing our attention on God, that this is part of our loving the Lord our God with all our heart and our soul and our minds. So it begs the question, where are our hearts? And Jesus in Matthew says, do not store up yourself treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will also. So where are our treasures? What do we treasure? Costa always used to say, if you want to see where your priorities are, have a look where you are spending your time, your energy, and your money. So our culture tells us a lot that we really need to impress other people, that that is something we should be building our lives around. We need to own a certain car or dress a certain way or have a certain look or maybe hang out with a certain bunch of people. And in my world, I work a lot with parents who are trying to impress other people by how amazing their own children are, how cute, how talented, how many prizes, how wonderful their marks are. And they're pouring a lot of time, effort, and resources into making sure their child achieves something. And sometimes I do wonder who it's for or why it's there, since you know, getting straight A's in grade 4 doesn't really get you places. I haven't had anybody ask me about my grade 4 marks, and pretty sure I couldn't tell you much about them. It's not really an entry point for anything. And most of what we do as people is fleeting and fickle. When we impress somebody, it feels like the goalpost moves. We buy something that gives us a temporary high, and then we soon find that it's kind of added onto the load that we carry, the things we have to maintain and store and clean and sort through. And instead of being a blessing, a lot of our stuff just becomes a burden. And when we celebrate an achievement, we have a little buzz, and then we start to worry, what do we have to do for the next time? How do we achieve the same level to get the same kind of accolades and praise that we got? And other people seem to withdraw their approval at a drop of the hat. It's very easy to offend and horrify people. So a lot of the highs of life pass by very, very quickly. Some of them trap us in addictions where they cry out for more and more time and attention, and they just don't satisfy. So we need to look at, well, how do we invest in God's kingdom? How do we store up treasures in God's kingdom? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought part of the problem is that a lot of what we're doing for God is very invisible. There's not an app that we have that we can measure. You know, we can measure our sleep. We can measure our exercise progress. We can track our habits on apps. But we don't have an app that says this is how you're doing in terms of storing up your treasure in God's kingdom. There's no bank account balance that we can consult about how things are going by building God's kingdom. And a lot of the time, we are building what seems to be completely invisible, because we are working with our own hearts and the hearts of other people. And the spiritual lives which looks so invisible and hard to track. So when I think back in my own life, some of the most important spiritual happenings that have occurred in my own life have probably been facilitated by people who don't know that they were part of something significant happening in my life. So I think of when I was maybe 4 or 5, I used to accompany my grandmother who was a Christian and liked to go and minister. And the one time we went to Rhodes Memorial, where she seemed to have a regular meeting with other Christians, sort of a prayer meeting, and she had a lot of friends there. And I was introduced to a man who suddenly felt the need to pray for me. And so he prayed for this, I think I might have been 4 or 5. My memory is a little hazy. But a feeling of such warmth and reassurance of God's love came over me during that prayer time that I really believe that one of the reasons why I'm here in church still is because of that experience. And I'm sure that man had no idea that something profound was happening in me. And so he was investing in something he didn't know that the investment came to bear any fruit at all. I had a grade 5 teacher who was also a Christian. I was a little scared of her initially because before I got to her class, she would go outside into the corridor and shout at children all the time for walking noisily past her room. So she looked fairly like one of those dragon scary people. But when I was actually in her class, I soon discovered that not only was she absolutely fantastic at teaching, and if you do look at my primary school records, grade 5 is the year where my marks were brilliant, and no other year. I basically didn't really work much the other years, so I didn't have great marks. But I was so taken by how she taught and the manner that she taught. And she also ran the what was called the Scripture Union, which was an after-school kind of SCA, where she would play her guitar, and she had some song sheets, and we would sing, and we would pray, and maybe there would be a talk. And this teacher had a profound effect on me. Sometimes when I attended my friend's church, I saw that she actually went to the same church as my friend. It's always enlightening to realize that teachers don't sleep in the cupboards at school. But sometimes children look at me in horror when they realize that I am out and about, and that, yes, I also go shopping. And I also go for walks or wherever they bump into me. But that teacher really inspired me, not only as a Christian, because she seemed to have a way of connecting with children that no other teacher had ever had. She had a way of seeing people and seeing children, and I felt very invisible when I was 10 years old. I was desperately shy and desperately quiet, so I was often overlooked in a classroom setting. And that teacher really made me feel seen and inspired me as a teacher. And I hope that as I teach, that my students who feel invisible also feel seen and feel that they have something significant to offer. So I know that I have benefited from many people praying for me, people giving me encouragement, people who've come to comfort me when my heart has been in pain, people who've prayed blessings over me. I've belonged to this church for many, many years, so a lot of those people are you guys. You guys who've prayed for me. Dylan and I actually walked into this church when we were 21 and 22. So you have been investing in us. We are your investment, a lot of you. And then God just working when I have been open and honest with him. When I've wrestled with my own fear or confusion or pain or disappointment and actually brought that to him as my sacrifice on the altar. And so as I go along doing my thing, whether it's playing my guitar or praying on a Tuesday or sending money to Hillside via EFT, or I'm trusting that God's taking this investment of mine and building his kingdom and building that treasure. And it made me think of a lot of you. Like Wayne, who has been preaching in the same church without promotions or markers of, yeah, you're really getting somewhere, you're really building something. Where we are building in a lot into what we can't see. And I have a belief that when we get to heaven, part of the delight of what's going to happen there is that we're going to realize how we were part of other people's story. I think we're going to have lots of incredible tales where we realize that something small that we sowed into grew to be a big tree. That word of encouragement, or that prayer time, or that picture that we had for someone else. I believe that God is using them all. And just like when we are hiking in the mountains, we often don't have perspective through most of the hike. We don't really know where we're going. We're just walking the next step. And sometimes when we get to the top, we see the view and we realize, oh, this is the path we've walked. That's where we were. And I think that a lot of the time we are walking and we're not sure where we're building our treasure. But I do think that God takes our worshiping, our praying, our wrestling, our interactions with him, and he builds something in our own hearts, and he builds something in the hearts of people around us. And we're going to be celebrating this one day. So now it's time to ask, well, what could God be saying to you now? Is he maybe asking you to sacrifice something? Something that you've been investing in that is actually not a good investment? Or maybe he is reassuring you or encouraging you about the journey that you've taken, the path that you've been on already. Or maybe he's challenging you to build something new, to get involved with something new, to pray more about something, to speak the kingdom of God's words over other people. Or maybe even to give resources to something that you haven't before. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to read David's prayer. Once he had amassed these resources and these skills, and particularly the gold, silver, and bronze, he broke into a song of praise to God for his provision. And I believe that God has provided us here with skills and talents and provision and times when God has really come through for us. And then after I've read this, then I think we're going to go into a time of ministry where we can ask God what he's saying to us now within our investment in his kingdom and building treasures in heaven. Right, so David's prayer is found in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. I'm going to read from verse 10. David praised the Lord in the presence of the whole assembly, saying, "Praise be to you, Lord, the God of our father Israel, from everlasting to everlasting. Yours, Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything in heaven and earth is yours. Yours, Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all. Wealth and honor come from you. You are the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all. Now, our God, we give you thanks and praise your glorious name. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand. We are foreigners and strangers in your sight, as were all our ancestors. Our days on earth are like a shadow, without hope. Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided for building you a temple for your holy name comes from your hand, and all of it belongs to you. I know, my God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. All these things I have given willingly and with honest intent. And now I have seen with joy how willingly your people who are here have given to you. Lord, the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, keep these desires and thoughts in the hearts of your people forever and keep their hearts loyal to you." And then he prays for Solomon, "And give my son Solomon the wholehearted devotion to keep your commands, statutes, and decrees, and to do everything to build the palatial structure for which I have provided." And so let's just go into a time of silence where we can ask God, what is he saying to us about our resources and what he's given to us? And perhaps as you start interacting with God, maybe he prompts you to go and pray for somebody. Or perhaps you really realize you would like prayer because God is challenging you to do something in a new direction.